I'm Dime Roberts. In 1989, I took a trip to Taiwan with my mother and produced a radio documentary about our relationship. It's called Mei Mei, A Daughter Song.
Well, I know Buddha take me to heaven. I didn't want to come by. She told me, it's not my time yet. If my time come, that's my home.
Mei Mei, A Daughter Song won the Peabody and was played all over the world. For the 25th anniversary, I've turned this personal radio production into a film. Join me November 21st at 8 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for the first ever screening of Mei Mei, A Daughter Song. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the KBOO homepage under Community Events.
If you are interested in country western music, tune in Saturday mornings from 6 to 9 a.m. for Swingin' Country on KBOO 90.7 in Portland, Oregon. That's Swingin' Country, 6 to 9 a.m. every Saturday morning.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. We have a good morning to bring you. Programming coming right up. It's Veterans Voice. As you know, it's the third Friday of the month. Today Angie and Marvin are here to honor the late Bill Byers, co-founder of the show. We're going to air an interview with him that Marvin did with him last year. At 10 o'clock on Air Cascadia, Chris Andre speaks with Allison Weir about her new book, Against Our Better Judgment, The Hidden History of How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, reaction to Obama's executive actions on the immigration front from leading Latino political activists and more. And at 11 o'clock, we hear author and activist Dr. Helen Caldicott on the Ukraine crisis. Is nuclear conflict likely? She is also joined by Stephen Cohen, contributing editor to The Nation magazine. And thank you once again, KBOO members, for your generous support. You can become a member if you're not one already by going to kbu.fm on the web and clicking on Donate Today. Thanks for doing that. We're going to start Veterans Voice this morning with the original recording, that the original theme song that started the show years ago when Bill and Marvin and others conceived of it.
I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield down by the river side and study war no more. Down by the river side, I'm gonna lay my burden down. Down by the river side, I'm gonna lay my burden down. Down by the river side.
Welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, and 100.7 FM in Albany, Corvallis, Eugene, or streaming on the worldwide web at KBOO.FM. And you can also hear some of our past shows if you go to KBOO.FM/Veterans Voice and Veterans Voice one word. You can hear some of our past shows. I'm Marvin. I'm here with Angie.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning. And we're going to play the show that we did with Bill, that we interviewed with Bill. And because it's a good thing to do, and we miss Bill a lot. And so we're going to do that. But Angie wanted to talk a little bit before we get going here. She wanted to talk about... Go ahead.
I want to talk a little bit, make a couple comments about the immigration speech that Obama gave last night. When he was given that speech, he was, in my opinion, doing a lot of Band-Aid fixes, like Congress usually does, like the president usually does. And I don't understand why nobody addresses the fact that NAFTA has a huge part to do with immigrants even coming here in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
People want to blame people from Mexico and South America for coming here. But in fact, since NAFTA started, the North American Free Trade Agreement,
NAFTA,
Mexico has lost 1.3 million farm jobs, and millions of dollars in subsidies to Mexican farmers have been cut.
Wow.
So the U.S. is going in there and employing Mexican workers, mostly near the border, and they're working over 12-hour days. Some of the women are getting mandatory pregnancy tests before they're allowed to work.
Jeez.
And another thing that's done is caused a lot of deforestation, because a lot of the farmlands are gobbled up by U.S. farm companies, and that pushes the farmers further and further out into the forest, which they have to cut down. So they've cut down over 630,000 hectares.
Hectares of...
Wow. A year.
Yeah. So we're going to play this song, this show that we had from Bill. Angie's having trouble with her mic, and they're switching mics, so we're going to be back here going just a minute. So, Angie, go ahead. It's probably okay now. Wait just a second. Here she goes. Tammy's in here. Angie's thing was bad. Go ahead. Try it, Angie.
Testing. 1, 2, 3.
Got it. Is it good, Tammy? Tammy?
Testing. 1, 2, 3.
We're having trouble with the mics.
Okay, that's not working.
Okay, let's just start the tape.
All right.
So we're going to play the show. We did it with Bill Byers. I did an interview with Bill. Bill's been with us my pal, for over 20 years, and I really miss him. And we were going to play this show for Bill, and I hope you enjoy it. Go ahead, Tammy.
Let's do a little background on you. I don't think people have always heard your voice and seen you around, but I don't think they know very much about you. Where were you born?
I like it like that. I was born in Southern California, Marvin, and my family moved to Washington, D.C. when my father got a job in the government printing office there. And then I spent about 10 years in D.C., which were wonderful years. It was a wonderful place to grow up because of the historic background and everything that was available to see as a young person. My brother and I used to wander all over D.C. and go to the museums and the art galleries and the botanical gardens and the Bureau of Engraving, watch them print money.
And you had a sister also.
Yeah, my sister was born in Tacoma Park, Maryland, actually.
Mm-hmm. And your mother, did your mother work?
Yeah, my mother worked. She worked at when the Pentagon building was built, my mother went to work out there in the G2 department, naval intelligence, I think it was, where she worked. And she got a job there. You know, anybody could get a job at that time. But my mother was a, well, you know, she was bright and she was a good person for that kind of work.
Mm-hmm. And was she from California also?
No, she was born in Minnesota.
Oh, Minnesota. Wow.
Yeah.
So after you were there, and then your parents divorced or separated.
Well, yeah, the family broke up, and my brother and I came out to Montana to live with our grandfather. And I spent 20 cold winters in Montana.
Out in the country.
Out
in the country. And your mother, did she live with you at that time?
Yes, at that time, uh-huh.
But you never spent any more time with your father after that?
No.
No more time with your father. So I was one of the things when you were back in D.C., we talked about this a little bit, was that there was the old soldiers' home.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, tell them about the old soldiers' home. That was interesting.
We used to go there when we lived in, I think it was over in Northwest Washington, D.C. We lived several places in D.C., and one of them was close to what we used to call the old soldiers' home. And these old soldiers, some of them were from the Civil War, I think.
Wow.
They were pretty ancient, those guys. And they would be out there in their wheelchairs and sitting on the benches. And we used to go over there on the first of the month, because they would always have a lot of money and they would always give us a few nickels, you know. They were really great old guys.
So most of those guys were either probably the Spanish-American War and...
I think so.
And World War One.
Yeah. Yeah, Spanish-American War.
World War One. Yeah, that would be... Did they ever talk to you about stories?
No.
Never did?
No, I wasn't interested in that kind of stuff.
At that time.
At that time.
Yeah, at that time. So after your family split apart and you went to Montana, did your mother worked?
Yes.
And you lived with your grandfather?
Yes.
And went to high school there? Did
yes.
you play sports?
Football.
Played football?
Yeah, at Boulder High School.
Uh-huh.
Jefferson County Free High School, it was called.
And Bill told me a story one time about how he got his first driver's license. Tell him, Bill.
Well, I went to the drugstore and bought a driver's license. It was $3, and that was a lot of money at that time.
Yeah.
But there was no tests or anything. You just went to the drugstore and wherever the outlet was, you know. And In this case, it was in a little town called Boulder, Montana. And you just went into the drugstore and bought a driver's license.
Oh, man, that's funny. And so you went to high school. Did you finish high school?
No, I didn't.
And you went to work?
Yes.
And what kind of jobs did you have?
Well, my mother... in the meantime had moved to Seattle to work, and she went to work for the 13th Naval District in Seattle. And so my brother and I went over to Seattle, and I got a job working out at a place called Pier 91, which was a naval supply depot in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, the war was just about to wind up at that time, you know, the... Uh-huh. This was in, must have been 1945, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So how old were you when the war started, World War II started?
In 1939, when the Germans invaded Poland, I think it was, I was 10 years old.
Wow.
And I was 16 when the war ended in 1945.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't... You weren't eligible for the... It is your brother. He's younger than you, right?
My brother's a year younger,
A year younger.
Yeah.
And so you worked... I also know that you worked in the mines up in Montana.
Up in Montana, yeah.
Went down underground.
Yes, I did.
How long did that last?
Oh, a year or so. It was, I had recently married, and I didn't want to go to work in the mines, but a friend, I was out of work, and things were kind of tough, and, mm-hmm. and so the friend of mine got me a job in the mines, and I went to work there. And it wasn't bad until I got my leg injured, and then things kind of went south.
Right. Did your brother work in the mines?
No. No, my brother was an apprentice printer.
Oh, like your father.
Yeah.
Right. So after you'd went to Seattle and you worked there, and then the war ended, then you were, did you go back to Montana?
Went back to Montana. Then went back to D.C., actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And you had to sign up for the draft.
Yeah.
At that time.
Well, let's see, when the Korean War started, when?
51?
Well, I got drafted in 51, okay. In January of 51.
1951.
My brother got drafted in February of 51.
Yeah, that's really, talk about that. That's interesting.
Yeah, well, in 1951, my mother had two sons. At Christmas time in 1950, and by Easter in 51, she didn't have any sons. They were both of us. My brother got drafted, went to Fort Belvoir, and then to Korea, and I got drafted and wound up down at the Nevada test site.
Right. So when you got drafted, that was at Fort Lewis.
Yes, I did my basic training at Fort Lewis.
And your advanced individual training, what was it?
We didn't have anything like that at that time.
What, really?
I was in the 231st Combat Engineer Battalion.
Combat engineers, right.
Yeah.
So when did you stay in Fort Lewis at the time?
Well,
you went to basic at Fort Lewis, right?
Yes, right. And then I went down to a place called Camp Conley, just outside of Atlanta, Georgia. And I went to Wheel Vehicle Mechanic School, where I was trained to be a mechanic in the motor pool.
A driver and a mechanic.
A driver and mechanic, yeah.
On the trucks.
And I had a GI license to drive anything that we had at that time.
Mm-hmm. How old were you when you got drafted?
I was, from 29 to 51 was what?
22 when you got drafted,
yeah.
And your brother was 21 years old.
Right.
And
yeah.
When he got drafted. So you went down to Georgia? Where'd
yeah.
you go?
Georgia.
Okay, you went down to Georgia, and then you came back up to Fort Lewis.
Yes.
Okay, then when did you find out that you were going to go down? What did you know about the Nevada test site? What
I didn't know anything about the test site, because when I came back from Georgia to Fort Lewis, my battalion had already moved down to Nevada. And so I followed them down there about a week or so after they got there. We just sort of missed connections.
So
they went down in convoy.
Uh-huh. So you were down in Georgia going through that school, and they had already been deployed down to the test site.
Yeah, just barely. They went down to the test site in, I think it was either September or October of 51.
Yeah. So did they never told you why you were going down there? They never told you what
No.
you were going to do?
No. We had no idea about what was going on. But the war was going on, and, Korea was a bad place to go, so better we go to the Nevada desert than to Korea.
to the Korea.
Yeah.
And so you finally left Seattle, or Fort Lewis. You got down to, how'd you get to Nevada?
I went down on the train.
On a train.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other people with you, military people with you?
There were several. Yeah. Stragglers, mm-hmm. we were following the battalion. The,
uh-huh.
My battalion was the 231st Engineer Combat Battalion, and we're the ones that set up Camp Desert Rock and
tell them about that. Well, first, I want to, before we do that, I want to say we are listening to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM, and we're speaking to Bill Byers about his experience right now about the Nevada test site, and we'll speak a little later about the war in Korea. But one of the things I wanted you to talk about before we get to the test site was when you got drafted, you took a train to Seattle or something, and there were all these guys that got drafted with you, and there were Native Americans?
Oh, yes. Yeah. From Montana. In Montana, in Butte, was the induction center. And a lot of Native Americans came from northern Montana. And when there was the Milwaukee Road was running at that time, and they put us on the train at the Milwaukee Road. And I think we had about a Pullman car load of draftees at that time that we went over together. And it was kind of a orgy.
Yeah. So some of the guys couldn't read.
Well, that's true. Some of them couldn't read, and some of them, the Native Americans, they had, when we got to Fort Lewis, you know, they cut their hair, made them get rid of their braids, and there was.
I bet that went bad.
It wasn't good.
Didn't you tell me some guy didn't have finger? Some guy didn't have
one guy had blind in one eye. He was they made him the company clerk. He's a good guy.
Uh-huh. And he was blind in one eye.
But he was blind in one eye.
And they kept him as a company clerk.
And another one of the guys that got drafted with me was had a hernia, so he wound up in the hospital the first thing when they got him into Fort Lewis. They got him into the hospital to repair that hernia for him. Mm-hmm. So they were taking anybody that, you know,
with war going on.
Yeah, they had a doctor looking in one ear and another doctor looking in the other. If they couldn't see each other, you were in. They felt you. If you were warm,
you were going.
You were in. Yeah.
It did. So a lot of guys coming off those farms, they had bad teeth.
Oh, a lot of them had no teeth.
No teeth.
Yeah.
So with these guys that couldn't read, that had to be hard for them.
Well, it was. It was hard for anybody that can't read. But these poor guys, you know, they had never been to town, for heaven's sake. So a lot of them.
Uh-huh.
And, I think the first pair of shoes they got was some of them.
Army boot.
Yeah.
Wow. So you finally got down to, tell them where Desert Rock is.
Desert Rock is it's about 60 miles kind of southwest of Las Vegas, maybe northwest of Las Vegas.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. And when we went out there, it was just the desert, and that's all there was to it. And we put up the tents and the living quarters, you know, for and the latrines and the water system. You know, they hauled water in from Nellis Air Force Base in the water tanks and put them in Lister bags. We had Lister bags to drink out of. And
you slept in tents.
We slept in tents. God, it was cold.
Yeah, Nevada nighttime.
Yeah, and my company was A Company, and we were assigned to what was called then the forward area, which was up close to where Ground Zero was and where the tests were actually taking place. And my company built the trenches for the soldiers. We built the bleachers for the observers, and did all the dirt moving and things like that had to be done. And then at the end of each test, we went into the test site and cleaned up the
mess,
the stuff that had been tested.
So how many tests had been done before you got there?
One test had been done. That had been early in the year. That had been in January of 51. Mm-hmm. They had done one test.
Did they use soldiers as guinea pigs? Were there soldiers there looking at the test?
Not at the first one.
Really?
No. Because, you see, when the war in Korea started, they were looking for a place in the continental United States to test their bombs, because they had to, up until that time, they had to haul them down to the South Pacific in order to test them. Mm-hmm. And the wise military people decided that they needed a place to test their weapons on the continent. And there were several places that they had to choose from. They chose the Nevada test site because it had been taken away from the Shoshones
right.
during World War II and used as a bombing site, like out at Boardman.
Mm-hmm.
And they decided to put it there. They could have put it, there was one site in, I think it was either North Carolina or South Carolina, that they could have, and then the westerly winds would have blown the fallout over into the ocean, rather than the fallout coming from the Nevada test site went over Cedar City and Salt Lake and St. George and those little communities. And I've spoken in those communities to the people and asked them about the effects of the testing, and the effects are not good.
No, a lot of cancers.
Yeah, indeed.
Oh, a lot of cancer. So when they were going to start doing the bombing series that you were in, it was called Buster Jangles.
Well, it was actually it was two series. One was Buster and one was Jangle.
Oh.
And Buster was a series of five, and Jangle was a series of two. And Jangle was originally supposed to have been in Alaska, but they moved it from Alaska down to the test site. And it was kind of a special test because it was underground, and it was, as I recall, it was designed to determine what the fallout was going to be of a nuclear device that was exploded relatively close to the surface.
Mm-hmm. But the first five were above ground.
Yes. The first one was a tower shot, and it failed to go off.
A tower shot? Tell them what that is. A tower?
They built a steel tower and put this nuclear device at the top of the tower and set it off. And, determine from the placement of the test, the material that was to be tested from various distances from the tower.
Mm-hmm.
But when Abel was the name of the first tower shot, and when they pushed the button, Abel didn't go off.
Oh, baby.
And so they had to go out and find out what was wrong with the... And we could see the guy climbing up the tower.
How far from where the troops were at was the tower?
Well, we could see the tower from where we were bivouacked.
And you could see the guy going up.
We could see the guy going up. And I later had talked to one of the helicopter pilots whose duty it was to fly out to the tower to see what was wrong with the bomb, and there were two of them, two pilots, and I think they drew straws to see which one was going to climb the
tower
to hook the wires back up.
So they didn't know what was wrong with it, so they had to crawl up this tower, an atomic bomb,
yes.
And to put the wires back together. Wow. So
yeah.
They did that, and
And they did that, and then the darn thing didn't go off. What happened was the detonating charge went off, and that didn't set off the nuclear charge, and the detonating charge just scattered radioactive material all over the place.
Oh, really?
It was just
horrible.
A horrible mess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, because when you see these pictures of the Nevada test site, how many altogether? Tested they do during the life of the test site down there? Do you know how many bombs they fired off by any chance?
I have the information here. It was many bombs had been tested there.
Were they all the same kind of bomb? Were they all, what was
Well, they
it?
Were nuclear devices.
Right,
I don't know whether
devices.
They were plutonium or uranium.
You didn't know that?
No.
Okay.
No.
For one of the, 'cause you know, I remember seeing pictures of the bombing, of those bombs that you guys, were you part of the people who built the houses?
Yes.
You guys built the houses.
And we built the animal pens.
The animal pens and the fences and the trees.
And the trees, yeah.
And all of that.
Yeah.
You went in there. And then after they dropped the bomb, how'd they drop the bomb?
From an airplane. The biggest one that I saw was 32 kilotons. And it was, I think it was called either Dog or Easy. I think it was Easy.
How?
Now, the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, those were 11 or 12 kiloton bombs.
Wow. Really?
So the one that I saw was about twice the size of, or the largest one that I saw, I should say, mm-hmm. was about twice the size of the bombs that mm-hmm. destroyed Nagasaki and Hiroshima.
At Ground Zero, were the buildings close to Ground Zero? Do you remember?
Well, they had them from various distances to see what the effects were going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow.
I remember, lost my train of thought for a minute.
Okay. So when they would drop the bomb and they went off, how long after the explosion of the bomb, the atomic bomb, would they get the soldiers up to walk them into the area?
Well, immediately after. Ooh. And they had, of course, they had monitors with them, and they would walk towards Ground Zero to determine, you know, they had Geiger counters with them, and they were to determine how hot the area was. And the closer you got to Ground Zero, the hotter it was, of course. Right. Mm-hmm. And they had come to an arbitrary figure. They have a discussion here with the Department of the Atomic Energy Commission at that time and the Army to see how much radiation that the soldiers were going to be allowed to absorb. And they had come up with a figure at that time was 3.9 rem.
Wow.
But then they went on to further discuss that now we wanted to do everything we can to keep this down to 3.9, but if some soldiers are overexposed, we want you to have a good reason for overexposing them. And you know how the Army
is.
Oh,
yeah, yeah, yeah. So did you were different than those guys because after say they had a test, the test went off, how many tests would the same troops see? You know what I'm saying?
Well, the one test in which the troops were involved mm-hmm. was a kind of a war game.
Whoa.
And the scenario for the war game was that the Russians had invaded Oregon and Washington and were driving south with their army.
Mm-hmm.
And the purpose of the test was to determine, and I have it in the papers here, to determine the physiological and psychological effect of soldiers in a nuclear
environment,
yes.
Mm-hmm. So how many, but they only did like one explosion, right?
Right. And that's in that particular series.
Right, in that series.
Yeah.
So would those soldiers that watched that, they would leave and they'd bring a new batch in?
No.
Really?
So well, they went home to their home bases,
right.
But they were from all over the United States,
right.
Those guys.
The only guys that had to stay there was you guys.
Yes, we stayed there for the entire series.
So how did they, Wow. See, how did they decide how many rims you guys got? Because well, you would be different than them because you were there a long time.
And they didn't count the internal, you know, we were breathing that dust and dirt all the time and up there in the forward area where we were. And we didn't have any bathing facilities. We had to go to, down to Nellis Air Force Base to take a shower. And until they got the shower set up down at Desert Rock.
So how far was the test area from Desert Rock? Desert Rock was the main camp, but the test area was farther away.
Desert Rock was, oh gosh, I don't know, 25, 30 miles maybe. Oh.
And that's where you you guys had to stay.
We were in the forward area.
Right, so you had to stay there.
Up towards area 7 or 10, I forget the name of it. They had it all platted out, you know, each area.
So after they would explode these bombs, the area was hot. There's no doubt about it. How long would they stay hot, do you think?
Well, they're still hot, for that matter. And you know, they wait for the, well, in all candor, they didn't give a damn.
No, they didn't. They didn't. So one of the things I remember seeing in some of the films, that after you guys would come back from going into that hot area to decontaminate you guys, they used a broom.
Sure. That's all we had was brooms. And the only clothing we had were GI fatigues.
Fatigues. And you wore the same fatigues.
Yeah.
So not only were you getting the stuff from the actual bomb, because you were there when the bomb went off.
Yeah.
You saw seven of them.
Yeah.
You were eating the food.
Oh, yeah.
So you were getting it that way. You were drinking the water.
Yeah.
You were getting it that way.
Yeah. Well, the water was hauled in from Nellis. So the water was in the Lister bag. They fill that. I forget how often they fill that.
But aren't the Lister bags tops open?
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's true.
They were open.
Yeah.
So after these bombs would go off, what did they do with the animals?
Well, they would gather the animals and examine them. And one of the purposes of the use of the animals, they used sheep and pigs. And the pigs especially were sort of, you know, like human beings.
Right.
And they felt that the effects on the pigs would be equal to the effect it had on a soldier.
Mm-hmm.
And they were supposed to examine these animals and then give us a report or put out a report on what the condition of these animals were in.
Yeah, did you ever see one?
As far as I know, it was never reported.
Never saw one.
No.
So did you were down there. They did all these bombs. The one that you told me about, I don't know if you were there when it went off, but the dirty bomb, the really bad dirty bomb that they had, what was that one called?
Oh.
Do you remember? There was something that was...
I forget the name of that, but that was after I had left.
Right. That really contaminated everything.
They did it intentionally, you know. They went off on a tower, and they had filled the tower with coal, and when the bomb went off, it blew this
coal dust.
Radioactive coal dust all over the cockeyed country.
How close was the nearest towns with people in them?
I don't really know. St. George and Cedar City were directly east of the test site. And the people in those little communities would go out in the morning. If they knew there was going to be a test, they'd go out and stand on the hills and watch the test go off.
But the sad part about that is the cancer rate in those little towns is just devastating.
Yes, yes. And it continues to affect them.
Yeah.
I spoke at a little town called, I spoke at Cedar City, and I spoke at Hurricane, a little town outside of St. George. And that was a combined class, I think about two or three senior classes. And I was on a speaking tour, and The question was asked of the audience, how many of your families have been affected by the fallout from the nuclear tests? And fully half of the audience raised their hands, indicating that they had been affected not well by the test site.
So what was some of the diseases did they have?
Well, cancers mostly, mm-hmm. and birth defects. There was a woman by the name of Terry Tempest Williams.
Oh, yeah.
And she wrote a book talking about her family. And she was from Salt Lake City. And the title of her book was The Clan of the One-Breasted Women, because so many of the women had
mastectomy,
breast cancer, and had suffered from, or had, you know, mm-hmm. been subjected to mastectomies.
Right. Wow. So on the soldiers, did after the soldiers would leave and they'd send them back to their companies or whatever they would do, was there any kind of follow-up on these guys?
None whatsoever, as far as I know.
None?
No.
No, they never sent out a form to fill out to see how you're doing?
Or? I was down in Florida one winter, and I saw a TV broadcast, or I heard a radio broadcast, where the Center for Disease Control wanted to talk to people who had been at the test site.
Mm-hmm.
And the Center for Disease Control was in Atlanta, I think.
Right,
it wasn't
Atlanta.
Too far from Florida. And so I wrote the CDC and I said, I would like to come up and talk to you about the physical effects, the long-range physical effects of exposure to radiation. But I never heard back from them.
Surprise, huh?
Yeah.
Surprise. And one of the sad things about this whole deal with the atomic vets is that your files burned up.
Well, yeah. I came from Florida. My wife and my son and I were doing the touring the country, and when I came back to Portland, I went up to the VA to file
a claim.
And so the guy that took my claim, you know, he wrote it all down and submitted it, and I went back to find out what the results of this claim were, and he says, "You've not even been in the Army." I said, "What?
What?
Yeah, I said, "You guys knew who I was when you wanted me, and now you don't even know me."
Yeah,
and they claim that the files were burned up down in St. Louis.
Yeah, St. Louis
at the record center.
Mm-hmm.
Why the files were all down at the record center where they could get burned up is beyond me.
Mm-hmm.
But it was kind of like the the soldiers that came back from Gulf War I. When their medical records were all
disappeared.
Yeah. Yeah, the discs were haywires. Yeah. You know,
uh-huh.
They pull those stunts.
Yeah, they still do. Was there any women down in the test sites?
Not that I know of or recall.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause that would be really interesting to see what their health is.
Well, you know, at the time I knew a little bit about nuclear stuff, and at the time, I thought to myself, well, the government is going to subject me to this exposure, and certainly they'll track me to see what the effects have been.
Mm-hmm.
Not a word. Besides that, burn up my record.
They burn up your record. So when after you guys had been down here, you went through the seven bombs.
Yeah.
Seven bombs. And then you went back to Fort Lewis?
I went home on a 30-day delay en route
mm-hmm.
At Christmas time. That was Christmas in 1951.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went back to Fort Lewis, where I was assigned to a water supply company that was being formed. Then I was to be cadre in this water supply company that was going to go to Korea eventually.
How much time did you have left in the military at that time?
I had a year left.
You had a year left. Mm-hmm. Okay. And all the guys that were at the test site went through all the bombing. And was there any illnesses at that time? Were anybody getting sick when you were down there? Like radiation poisoning or?
Not that I recall. But I know that most of the guys, or many of the people that were down there when I was there, are dead and have been dead for a long time.
And from what?
From cancer and from various radiation-induced illnesses, and from heart disease, which is one of the major effects of exposure to radiation.
Which you have, for sure.
Yeah.
Which you have.
Right.
So you came back up to Fort Lewis. You went through all that. How the heck did you get sent to Korea?
Well, that's kind of a funny story.
Funny.
It wasn't funny at the time, but now that I look back on it, I was going to be cadre in this water supply company, and so each company had to send a soldier of the week up to the battalion commander to be interrogated by the battalion commander. And so you go up to, you put on a Class A uniform and you report to the colonel, the colonel asked the muzzle velocity of the M1 rifle.
Tammy.
Go
ahead, Bill.
All those silly questions, what your serial number was, what the number of your rifle was, and all those things that you were supposed to learn or have keep in your memory. And then finally the colonel said to me, he said, "Soldier, what is your ambition in the Army?" And I said, "Colonel, my ambition is to get out of the Army." And sure enough, the Far East Command, FECOM, was a
dreaded word.
Was a dreaded word, yeah. And so my name went up on the bulletin board almost immediately, and I was assigned to FECOM, and I was sent down to, I think it was Pittsburgh or someplace just outside of Oakland. There's an army camp down there, and sent down there. And from there, they put us on a ferry boat, and took us up to Camp Stoneman in San Francisco, and put us aboard a MSTS general ship to go to Korea. With 6,000 of us on this boat. Yeah.
You're listening to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM, and we're speaking with Bill Byers, who is an atomic veteran from his time down in Nevada test site. He's also a Korean War veteran, and he's also a peace activist, big-time peace activist. And so they put you. How long did you have in the military by the time you were on that ship? You couldn't have had a year.
No, I didn't. They couldn't send you to Korea unless you had, I think, 8 or 9 months you had to serve before they could ship you overseas. Mm-hmm. And I kept delaying, trying to make sure that I made myself unavailable for shipment overseas.
Yeah.
But I had to shoot off my mouth to the colonel and
sent you over.
And I wound up in Korea
Was it
Yokohama.
1951?
Yeah. No, that's 52.
Your brother, by that time, your brother was already in Japan or in Korea.
He was in Tokyo.
He was in Tokyo.
At a printing plant that the Army had to print maps.
Ooh.
Because they had no maps of Korea when the war started, and so they decided they better get some maps. And so they sent planes over and took photographs and then made maps.
So you went to Japan before you went to...
Before I went to
Korea.
Yeah.
Okay, when you've... How did you get from Japan to Korea?
On a ferry boat from Sasebo. But in the meantime, I went down to a little town outside of Nagoya called Gifu.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to what they called at that time CBR school, which was Chemical, Biological, and Radiological Warfare School. And we were to be trained, the group of us, to be trained to be non-coms in the various companies that we were assigned to, or the various battalions we were assigned to show the other soldiers how they could protect themselves from the effects of nuclear or chemical or biological weapons.
And what did you find out, Bill?
I found out that there's no way in the world you can protect yourself from those horrible weapons.
Yeah, you're done.
There's just no way.
Yeah. And so you finally got over to your company, and it was a combat engineer, or was a
construction engineer? Yeah.
And what was that? What was your job there?
I was in the motor pool as a mechanic,
mm-hmm.
and then I was a truck driver as well, and we hauled ammunition and bridge parts and things like that up to the bridges that were being built in, up across the Imjin River and in Korea there are a lot of bridges and rivers, and the armies going up and down the peninsula would destroy the bridges as they left,
mm-hmm.
and so this was a constant chore to keep these bridges put back together.
Yeah, and plus you're hauling ammunition.
Yeah.
Were there a lot of attacks on your convoys? Was there any ambushes or mortar attacks on your convoys?
No. But there were, at that time, they were the we call the guerrillas.
Right.
The guerrillas were in the hills,
mm-hmm.
and they were all wearing those black pajamas,
right.
and you didn't know who the hell was
who. Yeah, who was who.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And so what time of year was that?
That was, from spring of 52 until Christmas time at 52. As a matter of fact, in 53, the ship that I was coming home on went across the international date line, and I had two New Year's Eves.
You got to get drunk twice, huh?
Not aboard that thing.
So when your time was up, you left your company. Was it winter time? Was it?
Yeah, it was
there?
Winter.
Oh, that was horrible.
Yeah,
that was cold, huh?
It was cold. It was indeed cold.
And so you left your company, and you had to go down to Seoul to leave the country.
Well, we were stationed north of Seoul, and we went to a place called Yeongdeungpo, which was the repo depot,
mm-hmm.
and then from Yeongdeungpo to Busan on the train,
mm-hmm.
and from Busan to Sasebo on the ferry boat overnight,
mm-hmm.
and then from Sasebo we got aboard a MSTS general ship,
mm-hmm.
To make the voyage home. It was mm-hmm. 2 weeks each way, 2 weeks coming and 2 weeks going.
Wow.
Across the Pacific.
Wow. So the one thing that you told me before we had talked about was when you were standing on the railway dock or whatever was on the railway dock, and you were looking out and you saw what they'd done to that country.
Oh,
that just broke my heart.
It was.
Those children.
Horrible. The children, you know, the children are always the ones that are most affected by the goddamn war. There was this one young kid, he must have been about 13 or 14, had one leg blown off,
mm-hmm.
hobbling around on a homemade wooden crutch, begging because, you know, the GIs would give him candy bars and chewing gum and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I remember watching the streams of refugees coming down from the north. It was
constant.
Yeah.
Constant.
And with everything that they could carry, you know. And then I remember one scene watching the bodies being fished out of the Han River because of an attack that had been made on this group of people.
Yeah, I remember that so many civilians were killed, and like even back in the 80s and 90s in this country, that they were still finding out about all the killings of civilians.
Yeah,
of all these civilians that had been killed.
And at the time the armistice was signed with North Korea, there were 8,000 MIAs.
Missing 8,000 MIAs.
Yeah, and there's still 8,000 MIAs as far as I know. Every once in a while they come up with some remains. Yeah. But
yeah, that's really because there was more missing in action in that 3 years in war in Korea than the 10 years in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And there was more KIAs killed in action in those 3 years than in Vietnam in 10 years.
Yeah.
More guys died in Korean War, and more guys are missing in Korea than in the war in Vietnam.
The Pentagon plays with those figures, mm-hmm. you know, as
coming
far
and
as
going.
The casualties mm-hmm. and...
Yeah, coming and going. So they had that many. So when you came back, you got out of the service.
Yeah.
You got out of the service.
I came back to San Francisco, and they took us up, put us on an airplane, and flew us up to Seattle.
Uh-huh.
And we went to...
You weren't married?
No.
Okay.
And we went out to Fort Lewis to get separated from the military. My mm-hmm. time was up.
Right. And you went in as... See, in the military, you go through different ranks. So the lowest rank is an E-1.
Yeah.
Then a PFC, and then E-4 and E-5. You went in as an E-1. What did you get out as?
E-2.
E-2. For 2 years, you never made any rank.
Well, that wasn't my objective.
It was to get out, right?
That's right.
It was to get out. So you stayed the same rank in the 2 years. You'd been down to the Nevada test site. You went through all the atomic bombs. Then you went to the Korean War, and you went through a war. And then you came out, and you never got any rank. You and my brother about the same. He was in the Navy, and he did the same thing. He did the same thing. So,
well, yeah, I wasn't bucking for any rank.
Well, you definitely were. Bill, what do you think that your health problems were caused by the Nevada test site?
Well, I suffer from hypertension, and I have for 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And hypertension and heart disease are one of the major effects of exposure to radiation.
Mm-hmm. Does the Veterans Administration compensate any of you guys for anything nuclear?
Well, they have certain cancers that they recognize
mm-hmm.
as having been caused by exposure to radiation. But as far as I know, cancers are the only things that they compensate for.
Not for heart yet.
Not for heart. And I worked on them, years.
I know. We're out of time, Bill. We're out of time. That was a fast hour. I want to thanks for listening to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM. You're able to hear this show and our other shows by going to www.kbo.fm/veteransvoice. We'll be back on Friday, August 19th at 9 a.m. And I think that we're going to have, her name is Jessica Goodell. She was a Gulf War veteran who worked in grave registrations as a Marine. She would grave registrations. And she will probably be on our August show. And I want to thank Bill. Thanks for coming in and doing this.
Well,
you've been on the show for 20 years.
For 20
and this is the
years.
First time we got to talk about what you did.
Yeah.
So thanks a lot, Bill.
You're welcome.
And
that was a pre-recorded interview that Marvin did with Bill Bowes, who recently passed away. And so there it is.
Oh, I marched to the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore.
in a thousand different fights. I was there at the Little Big Horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we won with a saber and a gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't marching anymore.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 10 a.m. Coming up on Air Cascadia, Chris Andre speaks with Allison Weir about her new book, Against Our Better Judgment, The Hidden History of How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, reaction to Obama's executive actions on the immigration front from leading Latino political activists and more. At 11, we hear author and activist Dr. Helen Caldicott on the Ukraine crisis. Is nuclear conflict likely? She's also joined by Stephen Cohen, contributing editor to The Nation magazine. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not yet a KBOO member, you can remedy that at kboo.fm and click where it says Donate Today.